Hey, welcome back to another Rethink podcast. Before we get into what I'm really excited about getting into today, let me give a couple plugs. First of all, today is the last day you can sign up for Rocky Mountain Men's Summit, which is August 26th, 27th, 28th up in Fraser, Colorado. I got some feedback that some people have automatically said, it's too expensive, I can't go. Do not let money be the reason that that you say no to something that's still possible for you. We have some scholarship money available, but today is the day. So get on jimbergen.com and register for that retreat. And we hope that you can make it there. The other thing is, if you're tuning in on YouTube, we release these on YouTube, if you didn't know that. The other thing is, if you're just listening to the audio, it's a week delayed. So lean into the YouTube, and it kind of brings another dimension to it. And share these podcasts with some men that maybe you think, I have a buddy who needs to hear that, and you can turn him on to that. Hey, speaking of the Rocky Mountain Men's Summit, one of our keynote speakers is with me today, a man who's become a good friend over the last 8 years. Just kind of discovered that you were snuck into our West Campus.
I snuck in.
Yeah, it's like, Do you know who that is? It's like, I saw his movie. Retired commander. Navy SEAL commander, Rourke Denver.
Yeah, buddy.
Like, I think you might be the most famous person I know.
No.
I don't know many people. Yeah. But
I don't think fame is really where I sit. Every once in a while I get made, but the cool thing about having done the film is when anybody says anything to me, us, the boys that did it, it's almost always thanks for your service, which is a really cool byproduct as opposed to, like, can I have your autograph, which I just think would be weird. So it's been good that way. But no, I still have freedom of movement when it comes to fame.
All right. The movie's Act of Valor. I actually got to go to the premiere of it and sat in a theater lot of former and active SEALs, and there were certain moments where it just got quiet.
Yeah. Yep.
Because it was like that. That was you guys made it really, really. I mean, there's a lot of SEAL stuff out there in Hollywood, and you like.
No,
that one felt real.
We really wanted it to be authentic without giving a playbook to Al Qaeda. So we're trying to strike the distance, right? We were trying to say, hey, we want this. We'd tell the stunt coordinators, they'll be like, look, that weapon doesn't do that, or we don't do that because you don't get to jump out of a third story window, do a barrel roll into an Aston Martin and drive away. Like, you call a medevac when that happens. So we want this stuff to be authentic, but we also would review all the footage because we're like, you know what? You don't need to show what we did on that corner before we wrap the corner. So it was cool. The film company was great about honoring that and being good about that. But you remind me of a story with the folks watching. One of the things that happened midway through is when we got about midway through the filming, they had put a little competition, you know, or a compilation reel together of the stuff that had been filmed to date. Because we hadn't seen any of it. And the director's like, look, you can't watch it because it'll ruin you. You guys aren't professional actors. You're going to see yourself. You're going to think you want to now start acting. And you guys are doing great. We don't want you to see it. But right before the last block of filming, they kind of brought us into this trailer to watch just this little, almost like a promo reel. And it was interesting because I came out and they're like, what do you think? I was like, I don't know. You know, you hear yourself on an answering machine. You're like, does my voice actually sound like that? You know, imagine that on screen. You know it because you're on screen. It's terrible. But I remember that one of the directors is one of the best motocross riders on earth, like both motocross, but then he's raced the Baja 1000 solo. I mean, he's just out of this world rider. And they have a race where all the Hollywood stuntmen do a motocross race. And if he shows up, everybody's competing for second. And if he doesn't show up, then somebody else can win. But his wife was one of the makeup people on the set. And she said, you know, it was really interesting. I married him post his racing career. So I never got to see him race. I never got to be part of that. And then she saw him at one of these races and, like, you know, he smokes it, wins the race by lapping people. And she's like, he's pretty attractive and, like, fun to be around this guy and see him do his thing. And she paused for a second and she said, I think your family's about to see you race. Which was so strange to hear because you're like, yeah, everything we do is in the shadows and I leave the house. I mean, nobody has access to what we do. And so it was kind of interesting to know that, like, yeah, some of our family will see a little bit what we do and how we do it.
Time out. So you had stuntmen. So you didn't really jump on a grenade?
I mean, it'd take more than a grenade.
Hey, the reason I wanted to talk with you today is, first of all, when we're at the summit, you're going to be talking about leadership.
Yes.
And I know leaders and I recognize leaders, and there's leaders and there's leaders of leaders and there's leaders of leaders of leaders.
Sure, sure.
And you're in that top echelon.
Oh, thank you.
And like, there's not very many people I say I would follow, right? And I think you would agree with that. I would follow you into battle anytime, not because of the Navy SEAL stuff, just because of your character.
I appreciate it.
So I want to talk a little bit about leadership, right? And we're going to try to cram. I want you to tell me everything you know about leadership in 30 minutes, right?
Yeah.
But I came up with a list of questions, but we'll let it go where it goes. But so you've been a leader. You work with strong leaders. You still do. You work in corporate America. Mm-hmm. It's like a room full of eights, that driven. They wouldn't be in the room if they weren't leaders.
That's right.
For the most part, right? What are the two or three characteristics of a leader that either you have witnessed or that that you say have to be in place?
Yes.
What are those? And for yourself, what do you look for in yourself going to be a good leader? Finish that thought. And then make a story out of it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, I would say without question, if you said to be a good leader, I need to lead in service of those I lead. So I think there's a lot of people that have not figured out that the higher you go up the chain of command, the further out in that C-suite office you are, the more people you now have the opportunity to be in service to.
That's good.
Anybody that is that, people will follow you to the end of earth.
That's true.
And if it's the opposite, if you figure, okay, the higher up the chain I go, the more power I've kind of garnered, now people work for me, you're blowing it.
Yeah.
And you might not know it, but your troops definitely know it.
Absolutely.
So I think that's how I define how I want to be seen as a leader. As far as the character traits or the characteristics, entire sections of Barnes & Noble are full of books about that. Mm-hmm. I think something that I make a distinction on is I'm all for character. I think if you're of low, moral, ethical, character type traits.
Hitler was a good leader.
Yeah, for sure.
He led a really bad direction.
So this is what I mean by that. Exactly right. Is I think sometimes there is such a adherence to character only. And I'm like, hey, not for nothing. If you told me like the first trait I would say is judgment.
Like wisdom
just the
judgment?
Ability. What's that?
Like wisdom judgment?
Wisdom and really just the ability to apply your knowledge, let's say that wisdom set, into functional decisions when it counts.
That's good.
Being able to make a choice, make a decision, hold the line and stick by your guns and do that. Because if you told me I had two doors and on either side of that door we're going into a gunfight and I had a leader of absolutely impeccable character but poor judgment, and then a leader on the other side that's like, a little shaky character, but outstanding judgment, I'm going out that door 10 times out of 10, right?
Yeah.
Because, character might not hold up in a gunfight.
That's right.
But judgment definitely will. Now, this is not to get rid of the I think, importance and the need for character. So judgment is huge. I make that as one of my kind of pillars of leadership. The second one, I love language and I don't think I've come up with a better word for it, is you could call it equity or equality. Now that's become a huge buzzword in modern times and modern parlance.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is sort of what I started with that service component, that you'll know you're in charge. You know, you're the person that's, signing the checks or the buck is going to stop with you, but your folks understand that you see them as peer in nature, that you're valued on a same level. We're just doing a different job.
Yeah.
So when we planned a mission to go on target, Iraq, Afghanistan, East, West Africa, wherever we were, I never planned the mission on my own. I never planned a single mission on my own the entire time I was in the teams. And in fact, I didn't plan the bulk of the mission. Look, I've got a navigator that knows how to, navigate vehicles and move through terrain with all the assets we have. Far better than I do. I've got a great cursory 50,000-foot view of it. If I had to do it, I could do it. He's better.
Yeah.
I've got a corpsman that's going to run our medical plan. I've got a communicator that knows how to run all our radios and all our connective ability to talk to one another. He's going to run the comm plan. And then even when it got to action on the objective, which is when we actually are doing the X's of O's, hey, we're going to hit this door and we're going to go through the target in this fashion, or this is how we're setting up this ambush. I mean, I'm a student of warfare, and we certainly train to a discipline to be able to be the person that could make the plan. One of my guys comes up with a good idea, but let's do that. Mm-hmm. And consequently, everybody owned it. Everybody owned the mission.
Yeah.
And then if the mission went well, all the credit to the troops. If it went poorly, it was my bad for even allowing that to happen.
That's just reality.
100%.
Yeah.
And so judgment and equality or equity. And then the last thing is just the ability to generate or create trust.
Yeah.
You got to get the folks to believe you're the man and can do that job and do it when things get bad, when things go south. And you know, trust is just, I mean, it's, there's all different kinds of ways to define trust: behavior plus time, repetitive ability to, you know, meet the challenge and take care of your folks in all different types of environments, that will generate or drive that trust.
That's good.
Yeah.
And that doesn't come automatic. That's shared experience over time, right?
Without question.
That's why you train and train and train and train and train.
Yeah.
That's, so, you know, my next question would be like, what are the characteristics of a bad leader? And it would just be the flip of that, right?
Yeah, it'd be the flip. I mean, here's a funny thing. Like, even as you ask that question, one thing I learned through shooting, and actually a mentor of mine post my time in the Navy really, really taught me this in shooting. I was actually going to a hunt. We've probably talked about this. There's a famous hunt up in Wyoming called the Wyoming Governor's One Shot.
Yep.
It's an antelope hunt. This group of guys, like in the 40s or 50s, were just, you know, ruminating on how the, you know, the mountain men had powder and a ramrod and one shot to get an animal on the ground and either make their living or put food on the table. So they created this competition where you only get one shot to kill the antelope. And of course, if you wounded it, they'd kill it, but you wouldn't be considered a hit if you don't get it down in one shot. And it was interesting when I went to that hunt, there's tremendous pressure on that shot. They've actually got a strange culture there where it's a big deal if you hit or miss. You actually go into a logbook for perpetuity as somebody that hit or missed that shot. And there's guides that have been guiding this hunt for 40 years for their opportunity to be on the Wyoming Governor's team, and a lot of them miss. And you're like, 40 years of experience, and it's just they put so much pressure on this shot that they overwhelm themselves with the stress of the moment. Now, the reason I bring up this story is the day before the hunt, you do a sight-in. So you sight-in your rifle. Sure. I mean, my rifle was absolutely thread and needle accurate. I knew it. I didn't need to do the sight in. But they had this little aluminum antelope at like 150 yards, and you got to stand and take an offhand shot. For non-shooters, that means standing with no supports, rifle on your shoulder, supported in your hands, and then you get a good shot. It's the most you're ever going to see your sights dance and move out there in the world.
You're not prone. You're not on a bipod.
You have to be standing offhand, so nothing to stabilize. Exactly. And I missed. I missed my shot. And I took time. I felt like I did everything right. Maybe I jerked the trigger. Maybe I just was thinking too much about it.
I'm talking about the aluminum.
The aluminum.
Okay.
The aluminum.
All right.
The day before.
Yeah.
And so I called my buddy who built the gun I shot. This guy by the name of John Burns. Phenomenal shooter. One of the best long-range shooters and gun makers in the country. He lives up in Cody, Wyoming's Wyoming Arms. Shout out to those guys. They've taught me as much about shooting as my whole time in the Navy.
Wow.
But I called John, and I was like, hey, I got to be honest, I sort of stressed myself out. I got up there and like I've taken far more high pressure shots than this, but I think just the, you know, whatever the moment is, I broke the shot wrong, whatever I did. I said, "What do you think?" And we started talking through it, and he's like, "You know, I think we're actually making a mistake in talking about what you did wrong. We should just talk about what you know how to do right."
Okay.
You know how to get sight alignment, sight picture, good grip, good control on the gun. You know how to do a proper trigger squeeze. You know how to keep your sights on the target and look through the sights of the target. You know follow through and breathing and stance and position. Concentrate on that. And it was a life epiphany in that moment where it's like, look, yeah, why would I focus on the thing I did wrong? I mean, you want to fix mistakes in life, but I think sometimes people just cycle on the mistakes, on the things they do wrong.
Absolutely.
So even as you ask me, like, what's the bad part of a leader, I sort of want to be like, who cares? Let's just focus on building good leaders. Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Because that applies to so many areas of life.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
100%.
So good. So talking about pressure, I can't imagine a more, I mean, every industry has pressure, right? You're kind of in a different league. You guys are pretty like legendary for that. But I'm looking for what's going to translate over to the guy running a business or running a family or running a team or something like that. What's been one of the toughest, like, stakes are high, I got to get this right decision? And it could be one that you got right, one that you got wrong.
Yeah.
But what are a couple of the toughest leadership where everybody's in the room's looking at you?
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to go left if you say left, and we're going to go right.
Yeah. I never had any issue, and I don't say this, I hope it doesn't come across as arrogant in any way. I never had any of those in the actual heat of a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that more so, not that I didn't make mistakes. I made plenty. I don't think I made any that were catastrophic to the point that it, you know, cost a teammate their life or we had mission failure because of it. But I think a leader in those type environments, and frankly, a leader of a family, a leader of a couple or a marriage, a leader of a business, all these principles remain the same. There's results that could be more catastrophic than others, but the principles remain the same. I just think you really have to trust yourself if you're going to be a leader that's worth their salt. And recognize that it's going to go wrong and that's going to go sideways.
Okay.
And you're either going to be somebody when it goes sideways that crumbles or folds, or you're going to be somebody that just keeps their head down and grinds.
Okay.
And so we do so much preparation, or really like almost inoculation for the fight. We do so many rounds and so many reps of shooting, loading and make ready a gun, setting up your system, your body armor, our trucks, our vehicles, our boats, our dive gear, our parachutes, that the first time you do it for real is not the first time. Right. I mean, I never was on the battlefield being like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And I also knew if I didn't know what to do, that ain't going to help us. So I'm going to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, we favor action over inaction at all times. The okay. only thing you can basically get fired for as a young officer in our organization is not making a call.
Right.
Like we see an officer freeze or unwilling to make a decision, we're like, this is not a job for you.
Okay.
But I see a young officer make a terrible decision, but do it with a little bit of aggression and some personality. I'm like, we can adjust off that.
Yeah, fail forward.
Yeah, like we could pull them afterwards and be like, hey, not for nothing. That was pretty dumb. But you definitely were willing to make the call.
Yeah.
So you're already doing right. We can train you.
Okay.
So I never had those. So to answer your question, though, as far as like the toughest leadership calls, it was almost always personnel and personal issues.
Okay.
Our guys were ready for the fight. It was, I mean, in 20 years in the SEAL teams, the only two problems I had were girlfriend or relationship issues and drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. And look, that'll ruin anybody.
Right.
So I always, you know, my pre-war speech, this is actually in Act of Valor, I give a campfire, like a bonfire speech in
on
that movie.
Yep.
That's the actual speech I gave to the guys. And when the director asked me, I was like, hey, I know you love Churchill and military history, and you could probably quote Sun Tzu and Genghis Khan. Like, you're going to come up with something awesome. I'm like, I'll give you my pre-war speech, but it's probably not what you think it is. Mm. And he's like, what are you talking about? I was like, I talk about balance. I talk about having the books cleared and the ledger balance before we go. Because if you have something that's a hang fire back yeah. here, mm-hmm. you're not going to focus out
right.
with us.
Right.
And so I was just like, look, everybody take care of each other. If there's something that needs to be sewn up, a bow put on it before we go, let's get that done.
Yeah.
And we do that for each other.
Yeah.
And then people could focus moving forward and really keep themselves in the fight. So all my tough decisions were personal issues. I had one that was interesting. I had a group of teammates that I was managing when Katrina was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my snipers was from Louisiana. And he came to me and asked for basically a leave to go home, to like take travel. It was during a training block, so that's very, very rare. And he said, I want to go home and, you know, I want to protect my family. There's like looters in our town or something like that. I'm like, okay. And then in the exact same weekend, I had another teammate that was going home for like his great grandfather's celebration of like victory in Japan Day. And it was going to be, my buddy had a son, so it was going to be four male generations in his family that were going to get a picture, and the great grandfather wasn't going to be around much longer. Super important. And I remember sitting in my room really wrestling with this. You would think, of course, the one I'm going to approve is going to be the guy that's going to protect his family. I'm not going to like let this Irish buddy of mine go drink a bunch of beer and hang out with his parents. And I approved the guy to go hang out with his grandfather and do that. And I disapproved my guy going home. Now, I brought the whole team in and I said, hey, I want to explain this so people understand my logic. I want you to know where I'm thinking. The reason I'm sending you home is you have maybe a once ever chance to do this with your family. I understand what a family man you are and how important that is to you. And then I turned to my sniper and I was like, look, if you tell me your parents, your mom, your family is in harm's way right now, and you can get home in time to affect that, I'll let you go. But I know your personality. You are a purebred meat eater, and I think you want to go home and shoot looters. And I'm not going to let you end up in Leavenworth.
Wow.
Now, again, if mom's in trouble, I'll drive you. If she's not, you're staying here. And, I mean, I wish I had a video image of the way this guy burned daggers through me in that moment. I think mostly because he knew I was right.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, he's like, yep, I was going to shoot people. I was like, I know.
Yeah.
You would have been shooting bad people mostly, but not that probably deserved it, mm-hmm. and it would have changed the trajectory of your life.
Yeah.
So it was decisions like that. It was like, hey, can you do this and not lose credibility with troops? Like, I'm going to let one guy drink beer, and the other guy told the whole team he's going to protect his family. And I'm like, look, if you say that's true, I'll do it. If that's not true, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And so it was those type issues.
So so you touched on something back in the one shot and then what you do with your teams and getting prepared and stuff like that. So in Romans chapter 12, it lists leadership as a spiritual gift, mm-hmm. right? So there's certain people that have it and that don't, but that doesn't mean it can't be developed, right?
Yes.
And so, like, is leadership, can it be learned? And like, how does a young young father, young dad, young starting out in business, you know, starting out in military, whatever. What I know you're breaking down doors and you're doing all these leadership training. Like, what are the reps? Because you talk to a lot of corporate guys, right?
Yeah.
Who are not on the battlefield. They're on the corporate battlefield or right, boardrooms and things. But how does one develop leadership at the level that you just described?
Yes.
That men want to follow? Like,
I think to answer the first part of the question, I think, and it's not a cop out. I've talked about this question a lot. What is, you know, is a leader born or made? I really believe it is both.
I did too.
So I think to answer the second part of the question, you can absolutely learn leadership. Okay. No question about it. Now, the finest leaders I've worked for and the leader I hoped I was when I was in charge, they have something special.
Yeah.
They have an X factor, or they have some presence or voice or your capacity to, you know, generate confidence and trust and, you know, followership in those that they lead. And that's, some of that is just innate. It just really is. And so I think some of that is born or given by God. But if you don't think you can't refine that and then learn skills and apply skills and read books on leadership and follow other leaders that are going to put more tools in your tool chest, absolutely that's the case. Absolutely.
Yeah, I find the best leaders are always learning.
They're constant learners.
Constant learning. And like, and it actually, like, so like I'm 60, right? Mm-hmm. And I went back to school this year.
Yep.
And then I'm asking some of my understaff to speak into my teaching, which I've been doing longer than they've been alive.
Sure.
And you just, they're confused. Like, you, why would you ask me that? It's like, because I have blind spots.
Sure.
And I'm talking to another generation, you know, and it's like, there's the leader I want to follow is what you said. The leader I want to be is, yeah, I have the biggest office on my staff in the corner with windows and my, but I want that door open as much as I can. I want to walk the halls and say, how are you? Right.
No doubt. And you really said it. The best leaders I've ever been around are constantly watering that skill set.
Yeah.
They're constantly seeking knowledge and they'll go backwards in time to learn from ancients. They'll go present with somebody that's doing something that they didn't really consider and think of. And they'll really take time to digest that, metabolize it. If it's something that they can assimilate and use, they'll do it. If they don't think it works, they'll throw it out.
Yeah.
I was very lucky in my career in that I my first two commanding officers in the military, for people that are in the military, that's like your first two CEOs, your first two top folks in the organization. My very first two, the first commanding officer and the second commanding officer I had in my first team, are individually the worst leader I ever worked for and the best leader I ever worked for.
Okay, describe those.
You want to talk about a gift to start your career as a young officer? You're like, okay, I definitely want to be him. I'm never going to be him.
Okay.
And it was just amazing to watch. And they could, I mean, it's like a Dick and Jane book. I mean, the one that was the worst was vindictive and emotionally and intellectually insecure. He would create little teams of sycophants that would be, you know, telling him he's great and telling him what he wanted to hear. If you challenged or had even a question, it was seen as a threat. He wasn't particularly good at making decisions. He just really had this personal, weight on him that he could never get out of the way of. And he created, I sadly worked for him more than I worked for the best guy over my career. Every command he was at became one of the most toxic places I ever worked at.
Really?
He just created the most toxic environment ever. I mean, as just a very simple example, we ended up at the training center. So late in my career, I run, you know, BUDS, of our basic training for SEALs. When I first got there, I ran first phase. That's hell week and all the like toughest instructors, and the highest rate of attrition takes place. Most people that are going to leave training are going to do it during first phase.
Mm-hmm.
We'd finish our swims or evolution in the pool, and our instructors, we had pull-up bars that went all around our training compound. We just hang our wetsuits over the pull-up bars to let them dry. Now, the students have these old, like, World War II wetsuits with what's called a beaver tail, so it comes up between your legs, and you snap it in, and you don't get full coverage for warmth. We've got cool ninja'd out, like, top-of-the-line wetsuits. And so when we hung it there, I always thought it was kind of cool for the students. They're like, man, if you make it through this thing, you get the cool wetsuits, you get the cool gun, the cool pair of sunglasses. You're like, I want to be one of those guys. So we threw it up there, and it was our training. It's a closed compound for the most part. And I remember one day this commanding officer comes out and he literally yells across the compound. He's like, hey, these wetsuits look like trash. This isn't this isn't a laundromat. I don't want those hanging up on the pull-up bars. I mean, instructors have been hanging their pull-up bars in this thing for like 50 years.
Okay.
So you're kind of like, all right, hey, it is what it is. The boss is the boss, and we'll do it. So we make a drying rack, and we put it there, and they hang and dry fine. The next day, the very next day, we're on the bottom deck where the pull-up bars are. He's on the top deck or a second deck with a big balcony around it. The next day after a swim, I see his wetsuit flipped over the balcony, dripping down onto the grinder. I mean, you want to know what all my guys thought of him? It was within 2 weeks of him being there. And you're like, well, they ain't going to follow you.
Right.
And it was just like, you can't believe this is real. You feel like this is the simplest, like, you cannot say, do this, but I'm going to do it wrong.
Yeah.
And get away with it.
Yeah.
But that was just him through and through. Yeah. So he was that guy. The other officer is a community legend. I mean, one of the greatest officers in the history, probably the U.S. military. Mm. I don't even say that lightly. I was at the team for, I think, 6 months before I realized he was missing the lower half of one of his legs. So this is pre-9/11. He'd lost a leg in a parachute accident, and we'd been on runs, swims, obstacle courses. I had no idea the 60-year-old man was on one leg. I was like, well, I guess we won't complain about things getting challenging
My feet
today.
Hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And he just was – he was brilliant. He was authentic. He cared about the troops more than anyone I've ever seen. When he answered the phone, he'd say, hey, this is – I won't say his name. How can I help? That was how he answered the phone. Blah, blah, blah. How can I help?
That's good.
As a commanding officer. So always looking down, always looking at the troops. I mean, he changed my whole path. The dude, like, I'll tell you another one that was so cool. I get emotional when I think about it.
Yeah.
He was a tremendous mentor. And he'd bring junior officers into his office, sometimes in a group, sometimes individually, and be like, let's talk about something. Let me teach you something. Or do you have a question? What can we do? And as I said, he's missing a leg, right? So he'd have these super high-end companies that would send him carbon fiber, advanced aircraft, aluminum legs, and they'd be like, cannot be destroyed. I mean, we ran over it with a train, and you can't break that. He'd break it in about a week and a half. And I remember one day I'm in his office, and I see two of these things shattered, just destroyed. And as I'm in his office, this phone call comes in. He would never do this. He's like, hey, I'm sorry. Let me take this call. I've been waiting for this engineer to get back to me. And he puts this guy on speaker. And he starts talking about, he's like, yeah, that one, you know, I broke it on a run. And the guy's like, it's impossible. No, there's no way. Like, he actually was calling my commanding officer out. He's like, I'm serious. We ran over with a bus. It cannot be broken. And my commanding officer is very pleasant, very cordial, and was just explaining what he did. And I had this moment where I was like, this engineer, the thing he couldn't figure out in the equation was human energy.
Mm.
He couldn't understand that, like, what's inside us, like what God gives us and that power we have, there's no math equation for that.
Yeah.
And the energy he was putting in that leg was greater than a bus. And you're like, dude, this is the good stuff. You think I don't want to follow this guy?
So
he
good.
Can shatter carbon fiber going on a run on the beach. And that was like, I'm in the right place. Like, this is the peer group I want to be around.
That's good.
Oh, it was killer. It was killer. Yeah, he was the best. He was the best. I'll tell one more. I love telling stories. This guy meant so much to me. We had a guy that had multiple DUIs, which one can easily get you out of the Navy.
Yeah, sure.
This guy was a great operator, though, great warrior. This was pre-9/11. And so, like, your greatness was kind of relegated to the range and bar fights and, you know, who you were with the ladies and drinking. I mean, it was a different era.
Yeah.
But he was one of those guys who'd be like, hey, if it's war, you want to break glass and he's coming. Like, that's one of those guys. But he'd had, you know, he's just a wild man, as many of our guys are. So he had like his, it was either like his second or his third DUI, which is an absolute headshot. Like, nobody's keeping you after that. You've just embarrassed the Navy too much.
Right.
But I remember we came to the office one morning, and the night before, a bunch of phone tree went around and was like, hey, everybody's got to come in their dress blues, their dress uniform tomorrow. So everybody gets dialed in, dress uniform. I'm in Navy blues. All my guys are in their blues. And I remember he had cleared out before he might have been in there in the morning doing it himself, but we had a big conference room and it was just all old, like, chairs. There's no, like, you know, not hardballed in, just like free sitting chairs. That entire room was cleared out. And I remember we walk in and the commanding officer, we were all in perfect ranks, officers up front, senior enlisted, then the junior enlisted behind us, plus the guy that was in trouble. He was standing like in the hall, but he was kind of with us. And then the commanding officer comes in and he stands in front of the whole team, just looking at this Seal, this guy that had made the mistake, but we were kind of halfway through the room, right? So, like, we're in, like, the backed up one side of the room. This guy that was in trouble was basically in the middle of the room. The commanding officer is standing there with all of us behind him. So it's like the entire weight of the command, you can tell, is there to present whatever the commanding officer is going to say. And it's what's called an open captain's mast. So captain's mast
big
is
deal.
It's a big deal. And they're usually closed. It's the first open captain's mast I've ever seen. So the entire command is there. He goes through the whole thing, the litany of charges and all this different stuff. He berates this guy. I mean, the guy's in tears. He's, like, having a hard time. It's rugged. I mean, it is rugged to watch. And all of us are like, this dude's gone. Like, his career. And he knows. He's like, my career's over. And then the commanding officer finishes all this, and he's like, hey, in the end, what I care about is what the boys think. So, if any of you behind me think highly enough of him that he should stay, you stand with him. And it was like no movement for, it probably was 10 seconds.
This is a trap.
It felt like
right?
an hour. Yeah, you couldn't tell it was a trap. And all of a sudden, one of the like senior chiefs goes walking in and stands behind this guy. And then another, and then another. And like by the time it was done, even if you didn't know him, you're like, well, if that much of the team has voted, now the entire command is standing behind him looking at the commanding officer. And he's standing there tall being like, now this dude is like on the floor. I mean, he's like a pool of emotion being like, the fact that these boys had my back is something special. Commanding officer's like, I'm going to bust you down 2 rank. I'm going to charge you like half pay for the next 6 months. You're now in charge of the worst jobs we're going to have for the next year, but I'm going to retain you and keep you. I mean, you think that's a command you're not going to want to be a part of?
Mm.
Oh,
epic. So good.
Epic. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
2022, right? And a lot of your stuff is pre-9/11. So you've always been a leader, and then you were military leader. Now you're leading family. You're leading all kinds of things, right? So I'm 60. I've been doing this 38 years, right? And my leadership that I always tell my staff is like, you can't do what we did in the 80s.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? You can't talk like you did in the 90s. You can't, right? And what have you, all the characteristics, all the values are still the same,
yep.
Right? But how is your application or your approach to leadership, or has it had to adapt a little bit over time?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'd say for sure it's just a constant draft in my mind. Like, your leadership path is just a draft that you should just be revising constantly.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, I don't have, none of it's written in stone.
Right.
There's non-negotiables that probably are, but even those, I've found very few hills to die on. I've found very few hills to die on. And I think when you do, you're in big trouble.
Okay.
You got to stay flexible and open and constantly kind of learning.
That doesn't mean compromise.
No. I mean, people that work for me knew there was a standard that had to be met and that I wouldn't break it. I mean, I don't drink. I've never drank. I grew up around some pretty tough drinkers, and my brother and I both kind of made a choice very early on not to drink. I think it's actually been I have a very intense personality that tends to go down the rabbit hole pretty hard when I want to learn something. So I'm sure I would have done that exceedingly well, which means exceedingly bad. So I avoid it. One of the things that was a real blessing in that is a lot of SEALs are partiers and hard chargers and do drink. The thing for me was that there were guys that were in the teams with me for 6 years and would like pass a beer at a bar to me. And like four guys would be like, how do you not know D doesn't drink? Mm. And it's because I never preached about it. I never like held somebody accountable to it. I'm like, this just isn't for me. Doesn't matter that I'm glad it's for you. It obviously lets you relax. I could probably use some liquid courage from time to time too, but I never compromise myself in front of my guys. Mm-hmm. I saw a junior officer one time had to be carried, passed out drunk, carried out of a bar. You're like, that's going to be a long road to live that down and to earn the respect of your troops. And so I saw that on a lot of different levels where I was like, look, there's things I can never compromise on. And my guys knew that what that was, being on time, having a better uniform, always constantly increasing your skill set and pushing harder. If, you know, a 10-mile ruck march into a target is about right, let's do it at 30. Because then we know anything inside 30 from here on out is going to be something we can do.
Okay.
So let's back it up. So the standard was always let's go as hard as we can so when we actually get into war, it'll be a reduction of what's required. But without question, if you're not constantly looking at, hey, how is my leadership affecting the team? How is my leadership affecting this individual? That's one thing, much like I told that story of the one I let to go home to his family reunion, the one I didn't let go to Katrina. That's a perfect example that you can't lead everybody the same.
Right.
I mean, if I'd done a one-stop decision on that, it wouldn't have worked out the way it worked out. Right. And so I think flexibility and just, you know, as you were talking about earlier, constantly learning, constantly pursuing. I like this concept of pursuit. My bride and I talk about this, you know, Tracy, and we talk about this a lot. Like whenever we go to a wedding, you know, and you got to sign the whatever they have, some where you sign and mm-hmm. make a little note, and it's always like, oh, love, and some like Shakespeare sonnet. And we just say, always pursue one another.
It's good.
And I just think if you're in pursuit of things, you're just growing and moving forward.
That's what the podcast right there,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Hey, let me ask you this. So leadership's learned, but it's also innate. It's a gift. So I have a feeling there's some guys out there listening going, I made a mistake. How do you recover from a bad leadership call? And, like, can you think of examples? Because,
yeah.
I mean, you do your best, and then you go, like, I just made the wrong call. Now, am I done? Or are people not going to trust me again? Well, if you make the wrong call, how does a leader recover from a bad call?
I think the first thing you do is own it.
Yeah.
You know, own it. And honestly, I'm for bringing it out. Like, I never thought secrets or keeping something suppressed was a good deal. And I learned this from, you know, mostly senior enlisted and probably that first commanding officer was like, you know, bad news doesn't get better with time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so don't keep – when stuff's going south, let's, like, have at it and get on it early. So I think that's important. I remember pre-9/11, and most of my career was post-9/11 in full-scale combat the whole time, but I remember pre-9/11 I'm doing what's called an ORE, an operational readiness exercise with my team. Team split up. One team's doing assault on a building. I'm doing what's called – me and about six guys doing what's called a search and rescue, a CSAR, which is a helicopter pilot has gone down. We're going into rescue and behind enemy lines. Well, it's in Chesapeake Bay and kind of in the inland waterway. So we're taking our rubber Zodiacs in to get them. I'm not driving. I got to be in charge. So one of my guys driving. This guy's one of my best friends to this day. And he keeps hitting lobster pots. He keeps hitting, like, the lines because there's all these lobster fishermen or crab pots that are in there. He keeps hitting the lines. It keeps throwing off our propeller and keeps screwing up the motor. We got to restart it, get going again. We got to restart going. I'm like, dude, you got to get this. Come on. Stop hitting these things. It's dark, middle of the night. Half of us are on night vision. One guy's on a thermal, and he's probably trying to drive naked eye, and he keeps hitting these lobster pots. And it's just, I mean, my timeline's getting screwed up. I'm like, we're not going to be there. We don't get this guy now. I'm going to fail the exercise. We're going to fail the exercise. And I remember he hit, like, the 10th one. I was like, get out of there. I'm going to drive.
Oh, no.
I mean, I had our prop fouled around 4 lobster pots, 10x worse than any issue he had within about 18 seconds. And I remember I just was like, I was all fired up. And he's looking at me like, oh, nice one, boss. And I'm like, I'll get in the water and cut the prop off. So I go down. I cut all the lines off. I get back in. And I was like, I'll never do that again. I'm never going to replace one of my guys that's doing his best. Mm. Unless I thought there was some catastrophic fail and then I could put somebody better in that moment. Mm-hmm. But I just think it was one of those where I was like, you know, this was the wrong call. I got, like, high on my horse. And now I'm not even doing my job. I'm trying to do his job. And he can do – I can't do all these jobs. That's what makes the team so incredible is we all have the piece of the pie and then do it together. So we've joked about it for years. And I was like, well, that's a good lesson learned. And so, yeah, I just – if I made a mistake, I was usually pretty quick to, like, call a foul on myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like playing pickup hoops. The good player is the one that's like, yeah, I fouled you. Yeah. And so I think if you can do that and then – but you also – you don't dwell on it and you don't – I think there's, like, a balance between – calling the foul, but also being like, hey, you're going to make them too. So let's just keep all working together to have the least number of mistakes we can come up with.
Right.
It's probably a point at which you make enough mistakes, you got to, like, retool things and look at, are you in the right position? Are you doing the right job? But in general, I think you earn way more credit, you know, admitting and kind of bringing it out to the front and working through it than trying to fake like it didn't happen.
That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, a while back you on your Instagram post, you posted some great stuff on there. I really suggest you follow him on social media, but you were quoting your daughter, you know, about idols.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of times men, especially, I was going to say younger and having something to prove, but I'm 60, men, right?
Sure.
So Do you remember the illustration about like the comparison and the?
Yeah, I remember she was having a multi-year issue with a particular kid that just was tough. I mean, they'd be friends sometimes, sometimes not, but a whole bunch was, I think, starting to migrate to a bad place where I was a little concerned as her papa, being like, man, you know, you're going to be a net result of like the people you surround yourself with. Mm-hmm. Make those choices well.
Yeah,
and I remember we got in the car. It probably came. I mean, to be honest, I thank Flatirons. I bet they had something in, you know, Sunday school that must have said it.
Yeah.
She literally said, I think I'm going to make up a name, so this is not the person. I think Julie is a false idol. And I was like, let me keep it together in the car. So she doesn't see me like, not like I care about seeing my girl see me get emotional. But I was like, that's incredible. I said, you're going to deal with it your entire life. And it's a huge thing to be able to identify that this is something that you thought was one thing and was this shiny object and an archetype or something that you wanted to be connected to. And now you're seeing that it's just like everything else, a work in progress, and maybe worse than that.
Yeah. So talk about the young lion thing though.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I talk about young, you know, either young people coming in the military or just young buddies of friends, I call them young lions. I just kind of think in terms of, look, if you're going to aspire to be something, let's go to the king of the jungle or the top of the food chain and be that top. And I think, you know, young lions in my mind are just this, they're just clay, right? They've got all this energy and all this potential. And then it's how can you shape them, particularly as graybeards? How can you, you know, get them on the path and get them, you know, to the best version of who they can be?
Yeah.
You know, as a parent, you think, and then I realize this in work too, that you can't make anybody be anything they're not.
Right.
But you can help them become the best version of whatever that is.
That's so good.
And I'd say that with leadership too, and I might be losing the bubble on the original question, but when I do very specific, mostly one-on-one, maybe a small executive team, when I'm talking to a specific leader, I'm like, don't go read a book and become like the servant leader because that's what you read. Or name the leadership trait. Be what you are.
Yeah.
I've seen tyrants that were like screaming, maniacal, very intense leaders, but they had great judgment, and while it wasn't fun to work for them, they were highly effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen very cerebral, quiet leaders that were very effective. And I've seen both be absolutely ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of that X factor, but you got to be who you are.
Right.
If you're not a yeller, don't yell.
Yeah.
If you're not a, I don't know, if you're not a thinker as far as, hey, I'm a strategist, don't be that.
Yeah.
We can teach you the basics how to do that. And so when you're an authentic leader and you kind of know who you are, you got a real good shot at winning.
So good.
Yeah.
Hey, so you've led forces all around the world. Now you're a full-time husband and dad of a house full of girls.
Yeah.
All right?
Yep.
So how is all this – how's it like leading your girls?
Yeah.
Because you cannot lead girls like young lions.
No.
Right?
No.
But you're also trying to build something.
Yeah. I mean, the gift for me when it comes to girls, I thought I was going to have boys. And it wasn't a desire. It was just a belief. You know, we just got a lot of men in my family. I got a brother, and my mom had only brothers, so it was all uncles. And everybody's a big, strong, tough athlete. You know, that's kind of who gets bred in our family, right? So I thought for sure I'd have boys. And I had two girls. My brother had a daughter as well. So what I didn't realize is, instead of it limiting my abilities, I feel like it expanded my abilities in many, many ways because I get to do both. Like I get to play rough and teach them to shoot and put them on a gun and go hunt and go fishing and do that. And I get to be at the tea party and dress up and go dancing with them and, you know, get them a set of flowers. So it's for me, it's very special to be able to, like, I think there's a spectrum I would have not had access to if I had boys. Boys are great. This is not a comparison. It just happens to be the way I experience it.
Yeah.
For me, I also think having girls, there's no question in my mind if I had a boy, I would think all my behavior would be an archetype for who he would become. Mm-hmm. And that would be a tremendous weight and challenge. And I would take that very seriously. I feel like there's almost, for me personally, another layer where that archetype might be who they choose. Mm-hmm. I cannot F that up.
That's good, man.
So I'm like, if I do this wrong, you're going to pick me, and then you're going to pick wrong. So it's another layer of like, okay, let's hold myself accountable. Let's make sure I'm doing this right. But, I mean, you know the deal. Having kids, if I thought complex military operations were a challenge, it's like, that's like preschool stuff compared to raising kiddos.
Yeah.
So, but for girls, for me, it's the balance between the two. It's how I carry myself as an example, and then how I, share my experiences. I mean, look, I'm probably the ultimate teacher of guys in some ways because I lived in this very archetypal high level warrior guy, male dominated cast. So for girls, I have to figure out a way to like strike the balance between. I don't think when I say this, it's gonna connect for you. If I said this to a young man, he'd be like, got it, because he's wanting to hit a tree and tackle something or kick something or throw a rock through a window.
Yeah.
And for girls, I'm like, all right, I gotta think about how do I teach this lesson, but not through the same vehicle I would probably use if it were a guy.
Yeah.
But I don't reduce it radically. I also think I want them, another thing that I really want them to do is I want them to know me. And there's times when I think, and my bride and I have talked a lot about this. She and I think are both high performers. And so I think sometimes we'll see our kids and they'll be real hard on themselves. And we're like, man, we got to make sure they know how much we screw up and how much we fall short and how much we're lacking and trying to be better. And we've been very, very purposeful, I think even just much more recently, of sharing failures and shortcomings and what hurts our feelings, this stuff. One of my daughters was having a very, very hard time with, she's in dance and she started later than a lot of her peers.
Mm-hmm.
She's got it. She's got like an X factor you can't teach, mm-hmm. but she's behind on some of the skills. And she was
kind of like you in jiu-jitsu.
And that's what we had a conversation about 2 days ago.
Really?
Yep. Yeah. She was in tears at the counter and I'm watching her and I start getting choked up. I was like, you know what? I have the exact same every morning at 5 a.m. I'm at the bottom of the ladder. I have the least amount of skills. Everybody thinks because of my background, I should somehow be able to supersede a set of positions and ability that you can't cut corners on. And so I basically have been losing for 2 years every day. And it's one of the hardest things I've ever done emotionally.
Yeah.
Because I don't do a whole lot of losing.
Right.
But I was like, I want to share this with you because I know exactly where you're at. And I could just see her like, be like, all right.
Ultimate me too moment.
Papa's having a hard time too. Yeah. I'm like, you're good.
Hey, let me wrap this up. Thanks so much.
Oh,
man, I'm looking forward to the retreat. But here's an aha moment for me in the last 30 minutes or so.
Yep.
If someone were to say, hey, what's Rourke like? And I get this all right.
Yeah.
You know Rourke, right? It was like, is he a badass? Is he a driver? Is he driven? Is he blah, blah, blah. Dude, you have one of the most tender hearts.
Big time.
Like you talked about your commanding officer and you went someplace else for a minute
for sure.
and here came the right.
Yep.
And you talk about those girls
yep.
and you talk about your bride
for sure.
Right. Yep. There's certain areas where you talk about a memory. It's yep. like, we can't lose that
for sure.
Right. It's yep. like, yeah, at the end of the day, it all lands on your desk. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's like everybody under our leadership wants to know, do you even care?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it comes through loud and clear. Then not only are you a strong leader, a smart leader, fantastic leader, a proven leader, you're a really tender-hearted leader.
Yeah.
And I think the moment we lose that, nobody wants to follow.
Yep.
Nobody wants to follow that.
My ever onward brand, that I kind of use for my, for my website, for my Commander's Coffees and those things, it's a bear walking.
Mm-hmm.
And I love bears, but one of the reasons I picked it is I'm like, in general, a bear like kind of likes taking naps and like warm and big and kind of just lumbers around, likes eating blueberries and salmon.
Yeah.
But if you get sideways with them, they'll take your head off.
Right.
I feel like that's a pretty good archetype.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Hey, if people want to follow you, tell us how we can follow you and learn more about you.
I appreciate it. Yeah. So I'm on, I think, most of the social media platforms. I say I think, and you'll laugh at that because it's not a vehicle through which I'm great at. My bride does a good job on, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. If you go to RourkeDenver.com, just my name, RourkeDenver.com, the best way to engage is you can send me something there. You can actually reach out to me if you want to, you want me to come speak to your team or spend time or do something like that. That can be achieved there. I do have something that I call my Commander's Coffee.
Right.
You can go to the bottom of my website, sign up for my Commander's Coffee. I release about a video a month. I don't crush your inbox every Tuesday with white noise. I only do it if I have something like I skip June. I've got one that I'll do in the next day or so that'll probably bridge the gap, and I'll probably add an extra one in August. But I don't do it to do it. I do it when I have something to talk about.
That's good.
And that's a good place to find me. And more to come, trying to kind of grow what's next. And I think you and I are going to have some fun doing it together.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
I cannot wait for this retreat, and I can't wait for the future.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, y'all.